Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for this term is State of South Dakota versus Jamie Benjamin Wright. For the appellant, Mr. Wright is John R. Henrich. Henrich, all right. From the Public Defender's Office in Sioux Falls. And for the State of South Dakota, Mr. Grant Gormley, an Attorney General from Pier. You may proceed, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Henrichs, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Jamie Benjamin Wright, who's currently serving a sentence in the South Dakota State Penitentiary. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Wright to ask the court to grant him a new trial, overturn the judgment of conviction entered against him. The issue in this case, we believe, is that the suppression motion brought by the defense before Mr. Wright's trial should not have been denied by the trial court judge, Judge Keene, on the grounds that Mr. Wright's confession, incriminating statement that was made before the trial, was involuntary. Trial counsel made a motion to suppress this incriminating statement as involuntary, and Judge Keene denied that statement, or denied that motion. My review of the case law, and we're relying on, of course, the constitutional protections against self-incrimination and for due process. In my review of the case law, which is in my brief, which was submitted several weeks ago, indicates that there are two factors for the court to consider when discovering whether a statement such as this is voluntary or involuntary. The first factor is the police conduct. Was the police conduct in and of itself coercive or manipulative? And the second factor is, was the person being interrogated or questioned, was that person's capacity to resist the coercive action such that his will could be overborne? In this case, Mr. Wright, a week prior to his statement to police, his stepchildren had been removed from his home by the State of South Dakota Department of Social Services. Mr. Wright and his wife expected to get their children back on April 18th of 2002. That morning, they went to the office of the Department of Social Services in Sioux Falls, expecting that their children would be returned to them. After a wait of several hours, Detective Blaine Larson, arrived at the Department of Social Services and told Mr. Wright that there had been a delay, that he needed to discuss matters with Mr. Wright before they could proceed. Mr. Wright agreed to accompany Detective Larson back to the Public Safety Building in Sioux Falls and discuss the matters with them. Detective Larson did not Mirandize Mr. Wright. However, we are not disputing the fact that this was not a custodial interrogation, because the record is very clear that Detective Larson told Mr. Wright several times that he was free to leave, that he would not be arrested that day, that this was just a discussion.
He wasn't forced then to go to the police station. He was, what, invited or requested? Would that be fair?
That would be fair. He was invited or requested.
All right.
And he complied. I would submit, though,
did he know at that time what the charges were as to his stepdaughter?
No, he didn't discover that until they reached the police station. Detective Larson took Mr. Wright back into an interview room and confronted him with the statements that the stepdaughter had allegedly made.
So he was aware of the allegations before he made the incriminatory statements?
He'd been confronted with them, yes.
Right, but not at the time that he, you know, agreed to go to the police station.
That's correct. When he was asked to go to the police station, the record seems to indicate that he was just told that there was a problem, that something was holding up the proceedings, and he was asked to come back to the police station to clear up matters. When they arrived at the police station, he was invited into an interview room. Again, he was not Mirandized. He was told he was free to leave. It's partially my contention that the atmosphere that was created was such that it belied how serious the situation was for Mr. Wright. Detective Larson told him This is a situation where you're free to leave at any time. We just want to ask you questions. And as the transcript, a portion of which I included in the fact portion of my brief, indicates, Detective Larson also told him a few times that it's our goal to reunite the family. As soon as you're done here, I'll give you a ride back to the Department of Social Services. We're trying to get the family some help. We've been confronted with these statements. We need to talk about them before we can proceed any further. And of course, that's a paraphrase of what happened. Ultimately, Mr. Wright was coaxed into making an incriminating statement, a statement that was used against him at trial, and a statement that was very much significant in his ultimate conviction.
You say he was coaxed. Was he told that his wife would not get the children back if he didn't confess?
At first, he was just told that it was the goal to reunite the family. And I think the implication can be read, if you look at the transcript and if you watch the videotape, that the whole family would be reunited. After several minutes, probably 15, 20 minutes, he was told that, well, the wife would probably get the children back. He would probably have to be removed from the house. Mr. Wright.
So there wasn't, was there or was there not a definite indication that his confession was holding up whether the children were going to come back home, whether he was there or not?
I believe that there was. I believe that there was a implication that the sooner he confessed, or the sooner that he made an incriminating statement, the sooner that the children would be returned to the home. There was never an outright promise. There was no quid pro quo promised. It was never offered as consideration for an incriminating statement, but the implication was there.
The officer, what did the trial judge find on that point?
The trial judge found that the statement was voluntary, that no promises were made, and I have the findings of fact that Judge Keene made, which should be a part of the record.
Did the judge take any testimony or make any credibility determinations about that finding, or to support that finding?
No, there were no credibility determinations regarding whether one party was telling a falsehood. I think that that's because there was a videotape of the interview, and so it was apparent what was said. I think that that was the judge's interpretation of the evidence that was presented.
Anything else that was offered in evidence other than the videotape? Did the detective testify and give his version of what happened?
Detective Larson did testify. His testimony discussed the circumstances leading up to the interview. He didn't get into the facts of the interview so much because he relied primarily on the videotape, although he did lay foundation for admission of the videotape.
Did your client testify about his perception of what happened?
No, the trial attorney chose not to have Mr. Wright testify, and I can't speak on why that was. This court has held that, as far as police conduct goes, that outright threats and so forth are impermissible in order to elicit an incriminating statement. However, this court and other courts have held that what are termed as psychological tactics are permissible. Unfortunately, my research, I haven't been able to find a definitive explanation of what psychological tactics are. I would submit to the court that implications, insinuations aimed at coaxing a statement such as the one that Mr. Wright made during his interview is not a permissible psychological tactic. While there was never an outright threat, if you don't confess, you will never see your stepchildren again, if you do not confess to this or admit to this, we will lock you up forever, we will hold it against you forever. There was never an outright threat of that kind made. It's our position that the insinuation, the sooner that you confess, the sooner that you make an incriminating statement, the sooner that you can reunite your family, it's our position that that is not a permissible psychological tactic, as the courts have termed it.
But counsel, was there anything untrue about what the officer said in that respect?
I believe that there was. I don't believe that the record indicates that the officer had the power to reunite the family, even though he said on at least one occasion, and I believe two occasions, that that was his goal, to reunite the family. I don't believe that he had the power to do so. He talked about counseling and therapy, as we see so often in cases like this. To the best of my knowledge, the officer never made any steps to follow through on that. So I believe that there was some element of I don't want to say that the officer outright lied, because again, it was a psychological tactic. I think it was impermissible to make insinuations that this could happen. I think Mr. Wright relied on those statements.
Weren't the children returned home, though?
Ultimately, they were returned to the mother. My office did not represent any parties in the abuse and neglect proceedings, so I can't answer any details about that. But ultimately, to the best of my knowledge, the children were returned to their mother.
So if the family was reunified, what was untrue about what the officer said?
There's no indication that reuniting the children with their mother had anything to do with Mr. Wright's actions in the interview room. Mr. Wright was led to believe when he went to the interview that he was there to clear things up so that the process could be sped up. And the officer said, we just want to talk about it when we get done. I'll take you back to DSS. It's our goal to reunite the family as quickly as possible, and that this is a hurdle to doing that. And I don't think that those actions, what happened in the interview room later, had any effect on what happened in the abuse and neglect proceeding.
But with the allegations against your client, the police and DSS could not have responsibly returned the children to this home before they cleared the matter up with the defendant.
I agree with that wholeheartedly, and I don't dispute the officer's responsibility to investigate the matter. What we're disputing is the officer's using that insinuation that this could speed things up in a way to get an incriminating statement from Mr. Wright. I don't dispute that he had the responsibility to investigate the matter, but I don't think he should have been allowed to use the abuse and neglect proceeding. And the pendency of that is a way to coax an incriminating statement.
Don't you have to also show, in addition to a threat, you have to also show that the threat caused the person to give up their free will and to confess, not because they wanted to, but because of the threat?
That's correct. The law, as I understand it, indicates that there has to be a direct connection. It can't just be a but-for connection. There has to be a direct connection. If you read the transcript, if you look at the videotape, you will see the officer say, it's our goal to reunite the family. The sooner we get this done, the sooner we can take you back to DSS. And ultimately, you can see Mr. Wright, as you watch the videotape, you can see his will break down in the face of this. At one point, he indicates, when the officer asks, this has been very stressful, and he indicates that he has, Mr. Wright indicates it has been stressful. What I understood from that was that the stress he was feeling was from having the children removed. When the officer indicated that the children could be returned to the mother, but that Mr. Wright would probably have to remove himself from the household, although the officer didn't say he'd have to remove himself permanently, Mr. Wright indicates that that's what he wants to do. He wants to expedite returning the children to the mother. And I think that you can see the direct causation if you read the transcript, or if you take your time to look at the videotape, which I'd ask you to do. I think you can see that the officer's questioning directly and insinuations were the direct cause of Mr. Wright's incriminating statement.
Well, the trial judge looked at the videotape.
Yes, sir.
And are we to give any deference to the trial court's viewing of the tape, or do we look at the tape de novo?
The question, you have to give deference to his findings of fact. However, whether or not the statement was voluntary is a conclusion of law that is de novo. And I think that you, since it's a totality of the circumstances, need to be examined. I think that you can look at everything, including the videotape, and draw your own conclusion.
Can you see anything at all that would have made your client feel like he was free to go while he was being interrogated by this officer?
Aside from what the officer said again and again.
Way early in the conversation.
Early in the conversation. Again, later in the conversation, there's a period where you can sort of sense that Mr. Wright is teetering on the edge of making a statement, and the officer does say, you're not going to be arrested today, you're going to go home. Mr. Wright asks, am I going to go to jail? And the officer says, maybe later, but certainly not today. So as far as the conduct of the officers, he wasn't standing in a threatening manner or blocking the door or anything like that, but he did indicate that...
Was the door locked?
To the best of my knowledge, it was not.
So my understanding is you're conceding that he was in custody.
That he was not in custody.
For purposes of That he was not in custody?
That's correct. It's never been, the trial attorney conceded that issue, and we're conceding that issue, that he was not in custody. This is a non-custodial. But I still think the question of whether the statement was voluntary is a legitimate question.
Who is the trial lawyer? Is it Chris Moran?
Mr. Moran.
Now, your client exercised at this hearing the right to remain silent, which she has a perfect right to do. But doesn't that kind of, in a way, put us in a position to have to speculate as to the effect these conversations had on him, the promises we're going to reunite your family and that? How are we to determine what effect this had on your client if he didn't tell us?
I think the determination can be made from viewing the evidence that was presented, particularly the videotape or reading the transcript, and imagining how a normal person would react in a situation like this. It's apparent that Mr. Wright seemed to be posed with the question of making an incriminating statement or perhaps never having his stepchildren returned, or at least indefinite delay of returning the stepchildren. And I think a person in that situation would make a decision that I don't think that this court should permit. I don't think the court should permit people to be placed in a position where they have to choose between their right to remain silent, their right not to incriminate themselves, or having their children returned or their stepchildren returned.
So you see this as basically an objective standard then, what a reasonable person in that situation would react?
Yes, although there are, one of the things that the court has to look at is the subject's capacity to resist the police officer's coercive manipulative questioning. And so I think that it's not necessarily a reasonable person, because I think that giving it that standard would be too hasty, because you also have to examine factors like the age of the subject, their education, their experience, their prior experience with law enforcement, whether they're intoxicated or not. So I would hesitate to ask the court to make it a reasonable person standard, because then I think that you would be ignoring those other factors that should be examined.
How important in the analysis would be the fact that he wasn't given his Miranda warnings?
I think that that's very important, because for a couple of reasons. Number one, obviously he was not informed that he had the right to remain silent, that he had the right not to answer any questions, and that what he said could be used against him. The other reason I think it's important is because it created an atmosphere where Mr. Wright didn't understand how serious the situation was. He was confronted with these statements, but then he was told he was going to be allowed to go home. He was told that he wasn't going to be going to jail. Later on, he was told he wouldn't be going to jail today. It created an atmosphere where Mr. Wright didn't appreciate the seriousness of the situation that he was facing. And I think that that's the kind of tactic, coupled with the other things that we've talked about, that would that could overbear his will.
So the key for you is the place it takes, where we have the interview. If they'd had it in a car or on the sidewalk, or maybe even in that social services office, that coercion would not have been there?
I beg your pardon, not necessarily. The coercion comes from the insinuations that were made in the creation of this atmosphere where Mr. Wright could not appreciate the seriousness of the situation that he was facing. A brief encounter on the sidewalk would create an entirely different set of facts, and I hesitate to speculate how he would react in that situation, but I'm not looking so much at where the interview took place as the fact that he wasn't told that he could remain silent, he wasn't told that these statements wouldn't be used against him, and then other promises were insinuated that coaxed him into making a statement.
The only way this would have been non-coercive would have been the Miranda rights. There's no other circumstances as far as changing the location that would have made this an appropriate interview.
I think that the totality of this, pardon me if I'm not answering your question, I'm doing my best to understand it. I think that the totality of the circumstances indicate that this was a coercive atmosphere and coercive line of questioning. If you changed the circumstances, those circumstances would have to be evaluated independently.
Sure, I'm just not trying to understand why it's coercive, and that's why I brought up the location and everything.
I guess in my mind, it's coercive because of the insinuations the officer made and because the officer minimized how serious, how significant the situation was for Mr. Wright. The way that he minimized it was by not Mirandizing him, by telling him that he was free to leave, by telling him that he wasn't going to be going to jail, that they were going to return him to DSS. So I think the combination of those circumstances are what leads to the course of questioning.
The officer keeps telling him that it's a small matter, some little procedural deal they have to get over, and then he ends up getting 55 years. It was no small matter, was it?
That's correct. It was a terribly drastic matter, and it's one that was life-altering, obviously, for Mr. Wright. And this statement that he made during this, in this coercive atmosphere, the statement that he made is directly responsible for his incarceration for 55 years.
He may be responsible, but is that, did that cause him to lose his ability to make a choice to reveal the information that he did?
I believe that it did, because I believe that he was placed in a position where he didn't understand the seriousness of what was happening, and he didn't understand the ramifications of his decision, and he was faced with choosing between having the children removed indefinitely or for a longer period of time, or having them having the their return expedited. I think your decision can be overborne, your will can be overborne, and your decision-making power is impaired if you don't understand the ramifications of what your decision is going to be.
How is that different than any other layman that's in a position of being questioned about something that they allegedly did that was illegal?
Again, I would take the easy answer and say it relies on the totality of the circumstances, and you'd have to examine each one independently. But certainly, I think officers, when they're interrogating a subject, should be conscious of the influence that they have over that subject, that the surroundings have over that subject, and whether or not the subject really understands the ramifications of talking or giving information.
Thank you. Your time has expired. You'll have a 10-minute rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Gormley. Mr. Gormley, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I don't think we have any dispute in this case about the legal principles or legal standard to be applied, so I think the important thing is to go to the facts and to look at the facts that took place in the interview. And I'd like to step back one step. I'm not in any way conceding that what was stated to this individual caused his will to be overborne. But let's look at the specific facts that took place in the interview. Originally, the interview started out with some friendly conversation about where he was from. And then the officer told him, here's what your stepdaughter said you've done. His response to that was silence. It was not to dispute it. It was not to claim that it didn't happen. His response was silence. Then the defendant was told by the officer he needed to help himself through counseling, need to put his family back together, need to put his life back on track. And when that happened, the defendant said, I never touched her. He did not confess to anything when he was hit with that indication. Then he was told, I know you touched her. And the defendant asked if he could go to jail, and he was told he wasn't going to jail. And he still did not confess to anything. Then the defendant persisted and asked, can I get the kids back quicker? And the detective told him the wife would get the kids back because he probably would have to remove himself from the household. He didn't confess after he was told that. Then, since he apparently didn't believe what the officer told him the first time, that he wasn't going to jail, he asked him again whether he was going to go to jail, and the officer said, down the road, there's a possibility you will. He still didn't confess to anything. Finally, the officer told him that the little girl loved him a lot, but that she was afraid to come home because she didn't want to get hurt anymore. And it was when he was confronted with that he confessed. Now, there's no claim here that that statement made to him was coercive, but that's the statement that caused him to confess. What the defendant wants to do is go back through what happened earlier in the conversation when he didn't confess and claim that that caused him to confess after he confessed after a statement about a different subject. It was only when he felt guilt when he was told that the little daughter still loved him despite the fact that he'd done this to her, that he confessed.
But we've always reviewed these under a totality of the circumstances. We don't sit here and slice and dice, you know, question, do we?
You don't slice and dice on totality of the circumstances, but it seems to me that it's part of the totality of the circumstances is to determine, as the court said in Tuttle, what actually was the moving cause that caused him to confess. And I don't get to ask questions, my hypothetical question, my whatever you call it. My question is, why is it reasonable to assume that when he was hit with the argument that he's now making, that he says caused him to confess, and he didn't confess, why would we assume that that is what caused him to confess? There was something intervening that happened here. It seems to me that the totality of the circumstances and common sense would say that you confess based on what you were just told, and not based on what you were told earlier when you didn't confess when it happened to you.
Doesn't this state
that makes a lot of difference.
Let's go to the test for a minute. Doesn't the state have the burden to prove that the admission or confession was voluntary beyond a reasonable doubt?
No, I think it's preponderance of the evidence.
They have to prove that
the state has the burden by preponderance
right.
of the evidence.
Well, how did they prove here that this was voluntarily given?
The way you know it's voluntarily given is you look at the standard tests that are used. He came voluntarily, and I might add, he not only came voluntarily, he came voluntarily with his wife. She came to the jail as well, and she was right outside the room. So it's not like he came alone and was left aside. He came voluntarily. He was told he was free to leave. He had prior experience with the system. He wasn't ill. He wasn't drugged. The thing took 50 minutes. He was not in isolation. He was not immediately arrested. All of the standard kind of tests that courts typically apply to decide whether this was a voluntary statement are met in this case. There's not a problem with those. He goes beyond that and says, but they told me the family might get back together. What he doesn't tell you is he didn't confess when he was told that. Sorry.
When he came, though, did he know that this is the questioning or the line of questioning that was going to be pursued?
Before he was in the room, I don't believe he did.
Okay, there was no indication that there was a child abuse or molestation or anything like that?
I'm not aware of nothing in the record to my knowledge would indicate that, but all of those standard tests get met, and then we go to, well, but my will was overborne. And his statement on the will being overborne is based on a statement when it wasn't overborne. And furthermore, if we look at the kind of tests that have been established in prior cases, it isn't met anyway. If we look at Tuttle, we talk about the case is just not the same kind of a case. That's a case where there was a coercion because they told him he was being a real jerk. And the argument was that leads him to believe that if he didn't confess, there wouldn't be leniency. And then it cited Tingle, and it said, Tuttle did, and it said there's a distinction between encouraging cooperation and threatening someone for failing to cooperate. There's no threat in this case. This is exactly the distinction that's being made in Tuttle. It's one thing to say in that case or in some of the other cases that get cited, telling someone, we're going to take your child away if you don't confess. That's a threat. But to tell someone, in effect, predict for them what might happen and tell them that, you know, it could help out is quite another matter. Judge Keene said, when he looked at this particular argument, he said, there's no deception or trickery on the part of Detective Larson. Detective Larson merely indicated that the resolution of the matter concerning the alleged abuse of the children would probably clear up and smooth the path for his wife and mother of the children to make some headway with the Department of Social Services. There's nothing threatening about that. He's telling them what's likely to happen. So they're really... The defendant in this case meets no test of any kind. He doesn't meet the standard tests about the location. He doesn't meet The tests in terms of coercive threats, there's no threat here at all. All he ever talked about were implications, and what? How do we arrive at implications here? What's Judge Keene supposed to do? He's in the courtroom, and there's a suppression hearing, and the defendant presents no evidence. And now the defendant gets up and says, well, yeah, but everybody knows I was being coerced. If he was being coerced, get up and say so, so the judge has something to deal with. He had absolutely nothing in front of him to make that kind of determination. But what's worse,
videotape, can we, counsel, though? We can look at the videotape and make our own determination, can't we, in this case?
I think so. I think it's acceptable to look at the videotape. Now, I guess you have the question about the level of deference you give to Judge Keene, who looked at the videotape as well and made a determination as he thought of it. But
why would,
frankly,
why would
I don't
give him any deference? If it comes down to just the videotape, Why do we need to give him deference on that? He's going to see the same thing we see, or vice versa.
Well, because he's on our side, and because you told us before you're going to give deference to what the trial judge does. So I don't know why I shouldn't take advantage of that situation. But I guess I won't prevent you from... I looked at the videotape. I didn't just take Judge Keene's word for it. Frankly, I'm not the least bit afraid of the videotape. I think the videotape shows no threats, and the videotape shows that this guy didn't confess because of what he's now complaining was said to him. He confessed for an entirely different reason. And actually, you have to give the defendant some credit in this case. Most defendants have no conscience. The reason this guy confessed is because he had a conscience. He felt bad when he was told that that little six-year-old girl still loved him despite what he'd done to her. That's what made him crack. He didn't crack because he was worried about whether he was going to jail or whether the mother was getting the kids back. That's pretty easy to kind of deal with on a non-personal, non-psychological level.
What's the difference between cracking and having your will overborne?
The difference between it is that he did it to himself. The police never... The police didn't overbear his will. There wasn't anything the police did that caused this.
You don't think that they conned him all the way along? I mean, you know, I don't agree with the defense that, you know, that they should have waived custody, because it seems to me that he was the only one being accused of a crime. Nobody else was. It was in the accusatory stage. It was an interrogation at the police department. They said he is free to go, but that's just a pretense. You know, I think he's about as free to go as, you know, if he had got out and said, I'm leaving, it had been interesting to see what would have happened. But anyway, then they tell him it's a small matter, and the whole ball game works on the basis of, and you're trying to separate out these statements, but these statements are a buildup of then what results in his will being overborne or him cracking.
No, I would say this, that if you can look at all these statements and combine them together and say, well, obviously this was sort of a compilation of statements that ultimately led to this. But that's what the defendant's arguing. There's no proof of that. It's if someone wants to make that assumption, they can make it in order to get the defendant off the hook. But I would say a common sense view of the world is, if somebody says something to you and you still deny it, that your will hasn't been overborne by that statement. And if then another statement comes and another statement comes and eventually you confess, I don't know why the earlier statements are logically and clearly a thing that caused the ultimate confession. There's certainly no proof of that. It's certainly just as reasonable to argue the statement that got to him was the last statement. That's just as logical as to argue all of it combined together, piled on, and eventually the last one was the straw that broke the camel's back. That, to me, that's something you can do, but it's just making up what you think happened. He didn't say that. He never said I had any problem with this. He never cried and broke down when he was hit with the statement about the kids coming back. That's not when it happened. So why is it, I would say, in my mind, why is it reasonable to believe that that's what caused it to happen? And You also said that he was the only suspect, and he wasn't really free to leave, or might not have been, or it would have been interesting to see what had happened. I don't know what we can do other than take the police's word for it. The police said, "You're free to leave." That's what's on the record. Those are the words. And it seems to me that it, typically in cases, that's what we look for. Did the police tell them whether we're free to leave or not? Not whether we believe the police believe they were free to leave when they told them they were free to leave.
It's not an objective view of the circumstances as to whether or not he really was free to leave, or just the words are enough?
I would say it's an objective view of the circumstances. If I'm in a police station and I'm told I'm free to leave, then I'm free to leave. The objective facts are I can go. My wife's sitting right outside in the hallway. I walk out the door, pick her up, and away we go. And I don't think there's any fact on that record that would suggest anything other than that being the reality. I don't see how a cop can tell somebody you're free to leave and then not let them go when they say, okay, fine. If that had happened and that were in the record, we'd have a different record.
But that would be coercive.
To tell them they're free to leave when you don't mean it and keep them there anyway would be certainly questionable. It would certainly raise a bigger issue. If I had the case, I might be arguing that was okay too. But that wasn't this case. This case is, there just is no argument here other than some implication somebody wants to make to create something. It's not in the record.
So you're saying he never really directly told, the detective never really directly told defendant that unless you confess, your wife's not even going to get the kids back.
Right. In fact, not only was he not told that, he was told that the wife would probably get the kids back. And he was told, I think at one point, that your wife didn't do anything wrong. When the implication, if we want to talk implication, is, well, then there's no reason why she can't have the kids back. The statements to him never suggested that the kids wouldn't come back to her. In fact, just the opposite. They told him the truth. The cop told him what would probably happen.
Are you completed?
I've said all that I can.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Nobody's chastised for quitting early. Thank you, Mr. Gormley. Mr. Hendricks, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Just a few matters. Mr. Gormley, when asked what the state's burden of proof in this matter was, indicated that he believed it was a preponderance of the evidence. I would just point out that was the burden of proof after the Tuttle decision. This case and Judge Keene's decision were arrived at before the state versus Tuttle decision. At that time, the statement had to be found voluntary beyond a reasonable doubt. So I would just like to point that out. Mr. Gormley has put me in an awkward position because he paid my client a compliment by saying that it was his conscience that led him to make this incriminating statement because he felt guilty about what had happened. However, I do disagree with his interpretation of the conversation that took place. The first thing that I would point out, and I think that we could all agree, is that a conversation is a fluid thing. It's not something that's divided up into significant parts and you can completely disregard what happened 10, 15, 20 minutes ago or what was said, the exchange that was made 10, 15, 20 minutes ago. The entire conversation, as you read it, is coercive. Mr. Wright was placed in a situation where he was made to feel comfortable. Mr. Wright was placed in a situation where he didn't understand the significance of what was happening or the ramifications of what he was being asked to do. It is true that he nodded his head yes after Detective Larson said that this young lady did not want to return home, that she was scared. But that was a buildup after several minutes of being told that this was going to facilitate returning the children. And it wasn't until very shortly before Mr. Wright finally made the incriminating statement that Detective Larson was trying to elicit that Detective Larson said, well, by the way, you'll probably have to return your, remove yourself from the home, but the mother will probably get the kids back. I'd refer the court to page 14 of my brief, where Detective Larson, so far unsuccessful in eliciting the statement he wants, says, there hasn't been one allegation against Mom. She's basically totally out of the loop on this whole thing. Even CG likes you. In her mind, you are her daddy. She loves you a lot. Mr. Wright says, I know that. Detective Larson says, but she is afraid to come home right now because Daddy has some problems, because believe me, she wants to come home. She doesn't want to get hurt anymore. Mr. Wright says, it has been so stressful. What I gather from that is it has been stressful having the children moved from the home for the last 6 or 7 days. Detective Larson says, I understand that. That is why I have been saying we have problems with girlfriends, wives, stress. We end up taking it out on the kids by hitting. Some people take it out by doing other things. Bottom line is we want to get them help, and we want to work on getting you guys reunited. So for the sake of not only CG, but for the other two children, I want you to tell me when this started and what you think we can do to get you some help, or maybe what you think is the reason for this. Do you think it's stress? Mr. Wright shook his head, yes, that was the incriminating statement. After he'd been made to feel guilty, as Mr. Gormley would put it, I don't think that's the reason for the statement. I think it's a statement as bottom line, we want to get them help, and we want to work on getting you guys reunited. And that was the statement that led up to Mr. Wright finally making the incriminating statement. As Mr. Gormley points out, Mr. Wright's wife, the children's biological mother, was waiting outside. Imagine how Mr. Wright would have had to feel exiting that interview room, confronting his wife, believing that the only thing standing between her having her children returned or not was a statement that he'd been asked to make, particularly when he hadn't been told what the ramifications of making that statement would be, that that statement could be used against him. I would submit to you that knowing that his wife was standing outside waiting for him, wondering what was going to happen, made him want to make the statement for her sake. At least you can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that was not a factor, that and that statement was voluntary.
Are you suggesting then that because he loved his daughter, he lied in order for the daughter to return to the mother?
I think that that's a possibility that the state can't prove is not true, and I think that the beyond a reasonable doubt standard requires the state to prove that that's not true beyond a reasonable doubt, and that they can't do that.
I thought you conceded that the preponderance of the evidence standard now applies.
No, I, in my brief, I said that Tuttle changed the standard, but that standard was not changed until after this decision was arrived at. I never meant to concede that the standard, that the burden of proof has changed. I think that Mr. Wright at the time had a right to have the voluntariness determined beyond a reasonable doubt.
Do you have some authority for that position?
I'm afraid I don't have authority for the position. I can only rely on the prior case law, which I'd always indicated up until Tuttle, that the standard was beyond a reasonable doubt. Judge Keene's ruling was beyond a reasonable doubt, so he applied that standard. I think that Mr. Wright is entitled to that standard because of when this case took place. If there's no further questions, I can answer. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Ordinarily, we take a 10-minute recess, but because we are on the internet live and tell our listeners that we run on the hour, we'll be in recess till 10 o'clock.